and welcome to another Meta Media production of JW on Purpose with your host, JW Najarian, as he interviews and discusses business, finance, self-development, and lifestyle. Hello, everybody. This is JW Najarian, and I'm very honored and excited to have on with us Dr. Ursula Cutlow. How you doing, Doctor?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Very good, and thank you. I know you have a very busy schedule, and it was so great of you to give up some of your time to speak with us today about a very important subject, and that is mood disorders. For everybody who doesn't know Dr. Cutlow, you're with Phoenix Children's Hospital, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And you're the interim chief of the Division of Psychiatry.
Yes, that's right.
And that's at the Neurological Institute of Phoenix Children's Hospital. You've earned your medical degree at the University of Massachusetts School of Medicine, and you went on to complete your pediatric internship at Brown University in Rhode Island, and a residency in psychiatry at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut.
That's right.
And now you also did you also trained in child psychiatry at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Right, that's where I did my subspecialty training to become a child psychiatrist.
Your resume is quite long. I've looked at it. It's quite impressive.
Thank you.
We're here today to talk about, I want to talk about a couple things, and of course we want to talk about mood disorders and what you do at Phoenix Children's Hospital. But could you tell me a little about Phoenix Children's Hospital and what you do there?
Okay. So what I do here at Phoenix Children's Hospital is, at the moment, I'm as the interim chief, I'm doing a variety of things, including some administrative work. I'm the medical director for the inpatient biobehavior unit, which is an 11-bed inpatient facility for children 12 and under. I do that in the mornings, and then in the afternoon I see outpatients for follow-up and for initial evaluations as well. And the other services that we provide include consult liaison service, which is child psychiatric consultation to the medical teams for the patients who are admitted for medical problems to Phoenix Children's Hospital.
Right.
So that's pretty much...
Let me make clear, because I don't think I made it clear up front, and that is that when we talk about, when we're talking about a mood disorder state, we are talking about children.
Yes. Absolutely. And with regard to that, we see a lot of children who are quite disabled by their mood problems. They can present with severe rages where they're threatening to kill people, threatening to kill themselves, hearing medication-induced mood disturbance. That usually implies that there is likely an underlying mood disorder genetically that's making them vulnerable to having that response to a medication for ADHD. So, you know, we see a lot of that. And so, you know, it's a very challenging, you know, endeavor to, you know, find a medication regimen that helps these children function better in the school environment without causing them to have mood disturbance or, you know, be at risk of harming themselves or others in the process.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about what is a mood disorder, but one of the issues that I wanted to ask, or one of the questions I wanted to ask was, are many of behavioral issues misdiagnosed? Or mood issues, I should say, are many mood issues misdiagnosed as behavioral issues?
I would say that's true. We see a lot of patients who have been diagnosed with oppositional defiance disorder, conduct disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, even obsessive compulsive disorder, and it ends up being more of a mood-driven process. That's one of the most difficult, I think, aspects of being a child psychiatrist is trying to tease out all these symptoms and, you know, in the context of, you know, family stressors, you know, changes in their lives that are having an impact on the child's well-being as well. You know, the level of, I guess, you know, parental involvement and, you know, how the parents are dealing with the behavior problems as well, if they're, you know, doing their best to discipline them and using appropriate techniques, that has an impact as well. And so you have to take into consideration all these factors, environmental experiences, you know, influences on these children and their emotions, as well as the genetic influence as well as what might be happening emotionally. For instance, if a child has a learning disorder and they are becoming suicidal because they can't function in school and no one's identified that, that really might not be a mood disorder. That might really be because the child is overwhelmed in their school environment and so overwhelmed that they're becoming depressed. And, you know, so you have to really take in consideration, you know, the whole picture with children, okay, you know, in all their environments, home, school, and, you know, family.
Okay, so let's clarify. Can you answer me what is a mood disorder and how does having mood disorder impact a child's well-being and functionality?
A mood disorder is a constellation of symptoms. The diagnosis is based on a constellation of symptoms where someone is having angry outbursts, depressive episodes, and sometimes euphoric episodes where they're too happy, laughing uncontrollably, that type of thing. And with children, it doesn't manifest as it does in adults. In adults, there's more of a pattern, and I'm speaking more to bipolar disorder, where there's a week of manic-like symptoms followed by 2 weeks of straight depression. It doesn't manifest that way in children. In children, they seem to have mixed states, and they do what's called an ultradian cycling, where their moods shift from moment to moment throughout the day and quite drastically. They might be playing happily, and suddenly they start hurling toys at their mother for no reason without provocation. And that's usually to tip off. It's not just a behavior problem. There's probably more of a mood-driven process. There is a variety of criteria for mood disorder. You ask if the child is, you know, having a problem with making friends, if they're having becoming openly defiant to teachers at school, as well as with parents at home, if they're getting to physical fights with peers, teachers, siblings, if they're socially withdrawn. Losing interest in activities that they normally would take pleasure in. And so, you have to look at, like, all these different aspects. Sometimes problems concentrating occur with children who are mood disordered. They're not able to pay attention. It's not like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder where they just have a problem being spacey and inattentive ever since they've started school, without having the mood disturbance. The children with the mood disorder.
What is the age range? Up to 18 or?
We treat children from whatever age they present to us. Like the earliest I've treated, I think, is 2.5 years old up until the age of 18. If children have started seeing us in treatment under the age of 18, we will continue with them until they transition to an adult psychiatrist after they turned 18.
I didn't have this question down on my question sheet, but it's curious. Do many adults that have mood disorders, do they start as children and don't know it? Does it just happen later in life?
That is very often the case. They might have been labeled as a problem child in their, you know, throughout their school years, and they might have settled down after they went through puberty and entered early adulthood, and then it might manifest in their 20s again, and it might not have ever been diagnosed or treated. one of the reasons I chose to become a child psychiatrist was because I wanted to intervene early, because not only are these processes genetically influenced, but it seems as if the brain being in these states of high energy and tumultuous, you know, emotional swings and the mood is kind of bad for the brain. And the neurochemicals involved and the firing in the brain seems to be a deleterious process that ends up compromising the emotional state of the person over, you know, like, say, a 10-year period where they've never gotten treatment and they've been this way. Then after a long period, extensive period of time without getting treated, it seems as if there's some physiological deterioration. It's based on what's called the kindling theory. The more episodes you have, the more intense they become, the more frequently they occur, and the less treatable they are.
So we can argue easily that the sooner you catch it, the better off the patient's going to be in the long run?
That's the bottom line. Yes.
That's wonderful.
So
did you have something to say?
Go ahead. Sure, go ahead.
I'm going to ask you, what are the potential difficulties? Now, I know you're at the Phoenix Children's Hospital, so you can't speak to the whole nation. So I'm just going to ask you, what are the potential difficulties with mental health patients accessing care in the Phoenix area?
Oh, that's a very loaded question. There's a lot of Arizona's a unique state. And one of the things that makes Arizona a unique state is that the welfare system has carved out the mental health has carved out dollars for mental health services. So someone who is on what's called access here, they have to only be going to see, they can only see an access mental health provider, a psychiatrist through an access clinic. And because of that, that limits it limits the type of services, what types of medications are available, and what type of inpatient services and are available to those patients because of that system. So, for instance, it creates a situation where children who are they're children who fall through the cracks. And the reason for that is because their parents might make just enough money that they don't qualify for access, and they might be in a job situation where they do not have medical insurance available for their children. And so when a parent is in that situation and their child starts exhibiting serious mood problems, they really don't have financial resources to help them to ensure that their child gets the care they need. There are times we've had to refer children who've been hospitalized under those circumstances. We've had to refer them to their primary care provider to provide the medications. We've had to be careful to prescribe only generic medications that are available at a more modest cost because the parents are paying out of pocket for those expenses.
Right.
And we've had to help the parents to reapply to see if they might qualify now for those services through access, or to encourage them to obtain insurance, even if they're, you know, paying for it, if it's not available through their job. Lots of parents have actually lost their jobs as a result of their children having such emotional problems. They haven't been able to function in school, so the parents get called from their jobs, have to go pick up their child frequently throughout, you know, the course of a month. They might fill out that Family Medical Leave Act paperwork to be excused from their jobs, but after a period of time, employers are only so understanding about the missed work, and it does jeopardize their jobs, even though it's not supposed to. It's supposed to protect.
I understand the financial burden is quite heavy, in fact.
It's very heavy.
Speaking together today is because of a concerned parent who called me. She's lost her job and states that she's also now having to sell her home because of the fact that the expenses are so heavy for her. And I think she fit into that realm. She just made just a little bit much money to, you know, be able to take advantage of some of the programs.
Right. And with regard to the access to care issue, because of the when children are on access and they need to be hospitalized, sometimes they the agencies overseeing those dollars will not approve a hospitalization at our hospital if there's another facility that they're contracted with, even if the other facility the parents are really not wanting their child to go there and really want to be at our hospital. It kind of creates a problem sometimes. There are times when I've had to go through a doc-to-doc review process for a five-year-old who is extremely out of control, and they'll say the child does not require hospitalization, and I've had to work around the system and get to know people within that system to kind of override that doctor's decision to not approve the hospital stay so that I could advocate for these children who really need an inpatient psychiatric hospital stay for treatment.
Is it easier for an adult patient to get the care they need than a child?
I really am not sure about that in this state. I think it can be difficult as well. I think the problem with the adult population is that there isn't a guardian or parent ensuring that they get the care they need. I did work in the adult system with the seriously mentally ill patients when I was in Tucson, and a lot of those people were homeless and were, you know, using drugs and alcohol to escape their reality, so to speak, and they would be coming in and out of the hospital oftentimes on a petition from a community member for involuntary commitment because the person was so out of control and was posing a danger to, you know, someone else in the community or to themselves. And so if the adults are not willing to get the help, oftentimes they're kind of left on their own until they come to the attention of a community member who realizes they're posing that danger.
Right.
So I think that there's a different type of issue with adult patients and access to care that has to do with their own volition, their own willingness to get the help, or their own awareness of their illness. One of the things with a mood disorder, if we're talking about a mood disorder in the bipolar spectrum, is a symptom called lack of insight. It isn't the same as someone being in denial of their illness. It's actually someone having a lack of awareness that they have an illness. So they might be throwing things and hitting people, and they really believe that other people are to blame for their behavior, or they feel that it's justified or explainable, and that anyone would react the way they did under the same circumstances. They have a deep conviction that they really do not have a problem. And so that really, especially with adults, keeps them from accessing care.
Wow, that's
it's a very profound a symptom.
Wow, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, we've already discussed that it's better to try to get somebody as young as possible with a mood disorder. In the future, what would optimize care for children with mental health needs at Phoenix Children's Hospital?
Okay. Well, I would say that there, at this point in time, there is a national shortage of child psychiatrists, and we also at our facility have a shortage of child psychiatrists. If we had a few more child psychiatrists, we might be able to have a more timely process of evaluating and treating these children. There are parents who come in to me saying, we made this appointment 6 months ago, and we're going to do everything we can to keep this appointment because things have been, and in that time, they couldn't find someone else to be seen. That's sort of normal, to wait 4 to 6 months to be seen by a child psychiatrist for proper evaluation and to start on the right medications.
I think there's a lack of child psychiatrists nationally or in your state.
There is.
Is it the funding issue?
I think that's known. Yeah, that's pretty known. I think it's for a variety of reasons. I think in medical school, a lot of, future doctors realize that child psychiatry isn't as lucrative as becoming a surgeon or, you know, an ophthalmologist. I don't know. And it's pretty labor intensive because you have to deal with interfacing with family members, with school officials and school programs. You have to advocate for these children, and you have to interact with the psychologists or social workers who are providing counseling and therapy. So it's very labor intensive, and all of that networking is not reimbursable. It has to happen either as part of your session or on your own time outside of the session.
Right.
If you're really wanting to be providing the optimal, services, advocating for your patients. I've gotten input from other providers. For instance, I know that some of the psychologists who responded to, I sent out the questions to them as well to have them give me some feedback. So one of the psychologists, Dr. Wolanda Smith, said that it would be really most helpful if we could establish interdisciplinary teams that had their own psychologist to help with children who have comorbid medical conditions and behavioral health or emotional problems, because their care is so complex because of having medical problems as well as psychiatric or emotional disturbance, and it makes for a much improved communication and better care if you can do that. For instance, we have a pain management service here that has realized the benefit of having psychology and psychiatry involved, in a more proactive way, because in the past these patients would be on heavy-duty narcotic pain medications and would stay in the hospital for extended periods of time, 3 or 4 months, and they found that they were able to streamline that process, get the children off those very strong pain medications and get them into other services using behavioral modification, the stress reduction, relaxation, and addressing their psychiatric problems that might be exacerbating their perception of their pain, so that they wouldn't end up with those long hospital stays, basically becoming dependent on pain medication. So it's made a significant difference. And I know they themselves are planning to fund a position here at Phoenix Children's for a psychologist to work exclusively with their team.
Right.
Cystic fibrosis, that's another one where there's a designated psychologist through grant money, I believe, where it's they kind of have, are paying for her position part-time so that she can provide the needed counseling and, relaxation techniques and that type of service to those patients. Dr. Smith was mentioning how if we had someone for sickle cell, children who are, who have sickle cell anemia, or children who have diabetes, or, you can see how it would be a great benefit to have more services available. And why we don't do that now is because, to be honest, it requires financial, support.
Right.
If you're providing a service that's wonderful, everyone thinks it's wonderful, but someone has to pay for it. And in the end, the hospital can't, subsidize indefinitely all these different things that everyone thinks would be wonderful to provide to the patients without there being some way to pay for those services. And the amount of compensation that can be achieved through insurance for these services doesn't really make up for the position.
So
the funding falls short.
Right. So the funding-wise, Are there grants and loans available? Are there other services available? Are there nonprofits that can help? And do they need to come up with more money, or what is the issue here?
Well, that would be the goal. The goal would be to try to establish perhaps an endowed fund to help support those types of services that would optimize treatment of children at the hospital. The other idea is that, you know, we would like to be doing more research with biobehavioral research along with neurologic research, like an interdisciplinary approach. To kind of further the understanding of, you know, various techniques or procedures or to understand the particular condition like epilepsy, that kind of thing. So that's another aspect that really we have very little going on here, because we're so tied to our providing the clinical service.
What I would say, JW, is that Phoenix Children's never turns a child away that needs care, but our ability to provide that care is quite often dependent upon the donations of our community and people throughout the country who really believe in the work that we're doing.
Right.
So if people are moved to make a donation, we certainly point them to our website, which is phoenixchildrens.com, and click on Ways of Giving, and there are lots of different ways there that people can be a part of the work that we're doing here.
That's great. So say that again one more time, Deborah.
The whole thing?
No. You want to get to the site. It's phoenixchildrenshospital.com.
Oh, phoenixchildrens.com, and click on Ways of Giving.
Wonderful.
If they're wanting to, because I think that, you know, in support of Robin Miller, who was the one who basically spearheaded this whole thing, she was really wanting funds to be earmarked for the behavioral health services at Phoenix Children's Hospital. So I think if there are people who are wanting to donate specifically to support the program development in the behavioral health services, they would need to make that known. And not that we would ever discourage someone from donating to the hospital in general, but you know, if they really wanted to donate specifically for, they have to communicate that in the process.
That's great, right?
And
one of the issues that, and tell me if I'm wrong. One of the issues is that the when you administer drugs to the children. Any kind of regime. The regime, first of all, it's adult drugs that have to be reduced, that have to be done in smaller quantities, and you have to come up with a cocktail that works for that particular patient, so you have to play around a little bit. Is that how it works? Or?
Yes, in some respects that's true. What I try to do in my approach is try to start with one medication, and then even if, like if a child's presenting with hyperactivity, impulsivity, reactivity, but they're also having rages, you know, I will try to treat the rages first because it's the safer thing to do.
Right.
And then might introduce a medicine for the ADHD-like symptoms only if those symptoms don't resolve after treating the what appears to be an underlying mood problem.
Right.
You know, so taking it in steps and having a more methodical approach, I think, certainly helps reduce the burden of that cocktail, and you know, and keep from having a runaway system where the child's on six or seven medications all of a sudden, and we don't know which one is contributing and which one is hurting, which one's maybe not doing anything. So you know, I think that it falls upon the child psychiatrist to be as careful as they can and as methodical as they can to keep from having a child be placed on too many medications simultaneously.
Right.
And you know, the along those lines, we do have trainees at our facility who are child psychiatry fellows who will be going on to becoming child psychiatrists. One of my goals would be to develop a child psychiatry residency fellowship program here at the hospital, because we have all the services that would I think that would provide excellent training with the consult service, in the inpatient service as well as the outpatient services. I'm collaborating with a local fellowship program through Maricopa County to have a psychopharmacology clinic where the fellows can rotate through with us, like two afternoons a week or so, to help develop their skills in treating children with psychotropic medications. What's interesting about our facility is that these are not your usual patients. Many of the patients that come to our facility have basically gone through three or four providers who have not succeeded, and many of them come from our inpatient biobehavior unit where they're the more complex and severely disturbed children. So it's excellent training for the fellows, and it's, again, it's more challenging because of the complexity of the children and their symptoms.
Well, we've talked about a lot of really serious serious subjects here. One of the good, on the good side, on the positive side, these treatments work, and they do well. I understand.
They do. They really do. And it's been an eye opener because I don't really like having to medicate children, though I'm a child psychiatrist. But I see that it's necessary. It would be nice to have also. I think if we could train future psychiatrists to really approach these things in a way that really is optimal, then the community will benefit in the long run from having psychiatrists who really know what they're doing and can really help these children. Too many times we see children coming to our inpatient services who have been treated with, a cocktail, as you described, that really has contributed to their mood disturbance. Mm-hmm. For instance, there's that black box warning on antidepressants now that they can cause suicidal ideation in children, but they can also cause mood swings, psychosis, aggression, and if someone has the underlying genetics that makes them vulnerable to a bipolar spectrum disorder. We see so many children coming through on those medications, and if the child psychiatrist involved is trained to really gather like an extensive family history, going into grandparents and cousins, and also trained to do an excellent mental status exam, really leaving nothing, unchecked, then I think they would come to the conclusions in a different way and perhaps start a different medication regimen and maybe prevent these children from requiring an inpatient stay. So this is where the training and development would, and I can't, there have been so many children where that's happened where, they come in on a stimulant, they've been trying to, like I said, choke their sister or whatever, they come in, we stop the stimulant, put them on lithium, a single medication, and they're able to go to school, they're able to concentrate, pay attention, they're no longer hyperactive, they're no longer wanting to hurt themselves or choke their sister, and it changes their life, and it changes the life of the family, because they're no longer, afraid of their child or afraid of what the child's going to do to their sibling,
Okay, so parent does happen to hear this, Dr. Cutlow, and wants to seek help for their child. Do they start with their pediatrician and go to a child psychiatrist, or do they have special programs? What's the first step?
I would say if they have access to a child psychiatrist, that it would be best to just go right to a child psychiatrist. And the reason why I say that is because there is a lot because of that kindling theory. The longer you delay that process and say, well, let's do a behavioral intervention, let's do all these other interventions before we even think about medication. I've learned to think differently. The medications are protective. They protect the child's brain from firing in that way that's causing the deterioration process.
Right.
So
right.
If they can intervene early with, maybe a modest dose of medication, then their child will function better more quickly, and will be less demoralized and be able to, you know, make much better grades, be able to learn, and be able to develop social skills with the peers at school. Because years can go by, 3-4 years, where a child isn't being seen by a child psychiatrist, and the gap between themselves and their peers is growing wider and wider, socially, academically, in all realms.
No, that makes sense, absolute sense. So let's talk about Phoenix Children's Hospital. We've all heard of Children's Hospital and the great work that they do. Could you give me a little information on Phoenix Children's Hospital and the work that you guys do there?
I'll take that one, if I may. This is Deborah.
Yeah, Deborah.
Phoenix Children's has been around for 28 years, and we've just opened a new tower that makes us one of the largest children's hospitals in the country. And the real foundation, though, is not the size of our hospital. It's the expertise of our specialists and subspecialists. We have about 45 different pediatric subspecialties represented here, of which pediatric psychiatry is one of them. And we have 6 centers of excellence where we concentrate on multidisciplinary care and providing the very best and optimal care for kids with really serious and often interrelated conditions. Psychiatry happens to be part of our Barrow Neurological Institute at Phoenix Children's Hospital, which is a terrific center of excellence that treats kids with all kinds of neurological conditions. And we've been really proud of that affiliation with Barrow and how much we're advancing care in the neurosciences. And child psychiatry is a very interesting and difficult field of study and field of treatment because the children's conditions are so complex, and it's not like you can just administer one test and know what the problem is or how to treat it. It's a very long and involved process, so I have a great deal of respect for our physicians who treat these complex kids.
Well, thank you, Deborah. That was Deborah Stevens from Phoenix Children's Hospital. This is J.W. Najarian, and we've been speaking with Dr. Ursula Kotlow of Phoenix Children's Hospital, a child psychiatrist at the hospital, and we've been talking about children's mood disorders. Any final thoughts, Dr. Kotlow?
Well, it just occurred to me that I didn't mention just that often what I see coming through is children who don't just have a mood disorder. They actually will have mood disorder with obsessive compulsive disorder, with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and they're actually separate. They're happening simultaneously. And that is, I think, the most challenging of the patients are the ones who come with 2 or 3 psychiatric diagnoses that all require treatment and a juggling of the different medications to help with each, the constellation of symptoms that go with each disorder they have. And I have to say that's probably the most challenging thing of my day-to-day, you know, job.
Let me ask you, because I'm going to be asked, I know it already, a lot of people will say diet is a big issue. Is it a big issue, and do you ask the patients or the guardians of the patients to change the child's diet?
I really, I don't find it to be as big a factor as I think a lot of parents are believing it is. What I think happens is that these children's illness is episodic, kind of like a flare-up of asthma that happens suddenly, unexpectedly, you don't know why. So they have periods of time in between when they're actually fine. They're not having rages, like, say, summertime when they're not in school. And so the diet gets changed, the child is calm, and then all of a sudden there's a flare-up, and they said, but the diet worked for 3 months, and then I don't know what happened. It stopped working, but it was really that the child was cycling on their mood swings. And they were in a euthymic mode of, you know, with even moods for that period of time because of the nature of the illness, which is cyclical.
Right.
I don't know if that helps to explain that, but
no,
that's my understanding.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of it is genetics bound.
It is.
That's why diet might not always help?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, I was trained psychodynamically to believe that, you know, there were all these other, you know, family interactions, relational dynamics, you know, the infant-child bonding that happens when you're first born and all that was heavily influencing a child's emotional state later. But I have to say that, by and large, it looks like genetics is the most powerful influence in terms of the mood disturbance in children.
Very good. Dr. Cutlow, I want to thank you so much for bringing these issues to our awareness, and for your time, and for the great answers that you've given me to these really hard questions. I also want to make sure that I thank Deborah Stevens and Julia Marston and Bonnie Morgan, everybody that helped put this together. I really appreciate it. We've been talking to Dr. Cutlow about from Phoenix Children's Hospital about mood disorders. And so I just want to thank you, Dr. Cutlow, for coming on and spending time with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
No problem. And I want to tell everybody, please check out Phoenix Children's Hospital. They do great work, and I want to thank Phoenix Children's Hospital for allowing me to do this interview today. Everybody have a great day and a better tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to JW on Purpose with JW Najarian. You can find JW on Purpose at jwonpurpose.com. JW on Purpose is the property and is a trademark of Meta Media Group, and this audio is copyright 2011, and all rights are reserved.